Michael. Bill. Charlie Goodlett. Feng Zhao. Jennifer.
Yep.
You sound asleep. Kathy Sulik.
I'm here.
Michelle. Raj. Tim.
Yep, I'm here.
Dan.
Here.
John Hannigan.
Here.
Bill Dunty.
Here.
Dale.
I'm here.
And Fenmore. All right. So, did everyone have a nice Memorial Day weekend?
No complaints.
Yes.
All right. As hopefully everyone got the message that we're going to try to meet on Monday, June 28th. And
yep.
Bill's right. Trying to still work out a location for that, but we're going to try to get together at 7:30.
Okay.
And this is just for the basic science group to kind of talk over where we are and what we're going. I'm assuming that everybody's got their proposals in, their continuations in.
Yep.
Did everyone send a copy to Jill?
Maybe. Well, mine is going in soon. And
okay.
Mine will be due soon.
They were due when today, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All righty. So, there's really no new business that I am aware of. I think the basics are going. Hello?
Hi, Ed. This is Charlie.
Hey, Charlie.
Sorry for being late.
No problem. I just got on myself. I had a little sprinkler problem this morning. As I was saying, I think everything in the basic science projects are going fairly well. And so is there any updates on – there's really no agenda for today. And if there are any updates, if people could tell us what's going on in their projects, I think that would be great. And I know, Tim, you and have been trying to get together on the ultrasound.
Yeah, that's right.
So could you kind of fill us in on what's going on there?
Okay, so, you know, we have a side project that was funded by SciFast to try to establish a set of measurements and to begin using prenatal ultrasound as a screening tool in our model system. And so we've done that. These are the measurements that are as parallel as possible to Andy Hull's group. And we're for our next set of animals that will begin breeding in the fall, we will collect those measurements. And Dr. Miranda and I are preparing a proposal to use the what we've learned from this side project to what we propose to do is try to model along what Kathy and Feng Zhao do with their mouse model with a point exposure. Kathy uses around 6 days, at 6 days, and we think that about 14 days we'll model that in a sheep, and this should be a time of neurulation and midline formation, and so we will expose the animals at this time, and then at day 76, we will study them in vivo and postmortem using ultrasound. The in vivo images that we hope to get, or that we should be able to get, should be somewhat similar to what are available to Andy Hall's group from humans. Resolution might be a little lower, but I think our resolution will be sufficient to get the same measurements that they obtain. But then postmortem, we're going to propose to use an instrument in Dr. Miranda's lab that is in a very high-resolution ultrasound system, and it should be able to give us the kinds of measurements, provide us the ability to get the kinds of measurements that you can get from MRI. It distinguishes layers of tissue, such as differentiation between cortical and medullary tissues, and so forth, very high resolution. So anyway, that proposal we hope to be putting in on the 16th, and that would be for an R21 application.
That's what I thought you were going for, an R21. Now, is this a the alcohol exposure is when, at 14?
Yeah, so in the sheep, it would be 14 days, and I've been consulting with Kathy on this, and her thoughts, correct me, Kathy, if I've got this wrong, are that somewhere around there, it should be comparable in her to what she does in her species, in the mouse. Is that, that's about what you and I have been talking about, right, Kathy?
Right, if all sheep are the same, because
right.
The sheep embryology data is based on what Binns and Keeler did,
right.
Or what Keeler did a zillion years ago before he did the cyclopamine work.
Right.
And so he has the best sheep embryology data, which we got from Cornell. And so it looks like a day 13, 14 sheep is like about a day 7 mouse.
Kathy, this is Charlie. Is there any reason to just expand the number of days just to make sure, or is...
Yeah, I think there's every reason. And I just quickly looked, Tim, at the way you had your proposal written, and you had expanded it. You went all the way from day 10 to day 14, right?
Right. I think to get a high enough BAC, what we will have to do is we'll have to create some tolerance by beginning ahead of time. So what I would propose is that we'd begin at day 10 and then hit our plateaus around 13 and proceed through day 14.
Yeah, because that was my question of whether...
Yeah, I had the same.
Because of the difference in the gestation length of the...
And the fact that you have to wait another 60 days or 40 days or whatever it is...
To find the answer.
You don't want to miss it.
Yeah, I'm a little... So what happens in our mice is the day 7 exposure, we get our midline brain problems, the severe midline brain problems. If you go to day, just one day later in the mouse, you get a lot of heart defects, and that kills the embryos early. And so they're more sensitive to a lethal dose. The LD50 is much lower on day 8 in our mice than it is on day 7. And I'm worried that if you take it out much longer in the sheep, you might start killing them early.
Tim, what would be the dose that you're using? What would be the expected BAC profile?
So we'd start with the same dose that we're using right now, consistently, which would give us between 225 and 275 milligrams per deciliter, and then we would repeat that for 2 or 3 days, and then increase it to 2, and then increase it to 2.5. So I would like to get to 2.25, and I believe that would give us around 325, 340 milligrams per deciliter.
That's less than Kathy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I think
Kathy,
yours are around...
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Would you be able to identify fetal death early on if you get that?
We would know by between 22 and 25 days is when we do our standard ultrasonographic scan for pregnancy. So, you know, we would be dosing these animals before we could determine that they were pregnant. And then, you know, it would be just a week and a half later where we could come back and determine that they were viable, because we look for a fetal heartbeat.
So you could adjust this if you need to on the fly.
Right. We could start. We'll start as early as we can in the breeding season whenever this is. We can start this project, and then we would. We would make sure that we have viable fetuses before we waited all that long.
All right. Any other questions on this?
Ed, it's Michael. I just wanted to mention I've been on for a little while.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Did you have a good Memorial Day?
I did. How about you?
I did. Very relaxing. And, I was in Russia last week, and so this was kind of a rest up and catch up.
That's great.
All right, Kathy? You want to update us on what's going on?
Oh, we're busy getting ready for the RSA. We're perking along fairly well on what we're doing. The 9 Tesla magnet had a meltdown a few weeks ago, and it was a major one. Al said it only had happened to him one time before. Or he had had, they call it a quench or
quenching.
Something. Yeah. And it did that. And so that screws us up a lot because we have animals that we've bred and we know exactly what date they're going to come available and whatever. And so we've lost probably more than a month's time because we have to start over because we can't store the animals for very long in the contrast agent. So anyway, we had a glitch, and I think we should be back operating again soon, but we lost a lot of material.
Do you have alternative uses for those animals?
Yeah, we can do histology, regular histology on them, and that's what we're doing.
Okay.
So, but, you know, we...
And when do they think they'll get the magnet back up?
I think it's back up now. They managed to get it up quicker than they thought. But then we also have problems with scheduling time. Al gives us as much as possible, but he has other people who are doing things too. So the whole calendar got changed, and anyway, we're trying to recover.
How long has it been up? And sometimes it takes some time to
calibrate it.
Field homogeneities and
yeah,
all that stuff.
I think it's only been up a few days.
Okay.
So anyway, what can happen will happen. It happened.
Well, luckily, I think you're ahead of your targets on everything. So.
Yeah, we're pretty happy with our progress, and we've got, you know, backlogs of material that we can continue to segment. So we're not twiddling our thumbs, but we're still, you know, not. We lost a month.
Yeah. All right, Jennifer.
Yeah, we're just finishing our production of the last study. These are the animals that have been exposed to alcohol prenatally and then also given different diets of choline. And yet some that weren't pregnant, so we had to do another bunch, but we're just about finished with that. So just wrapping things up. Hopefully we haven't heard anything, and I got Jan in touch with Zizel's people, and I haven't heard anything lately if they're, how their progress is going.
So have you been in touch with Davis at all? You know, you see Davis?
Yeah, with Jan, and the last that I spoke with them, I had gotten them in contact with Zizel. She was in talking to their technician to try to troubleshoot their what problems they've been having.
All right. Charlie, you got anything you need to add in here?
No. Whatever Tim might want to add from the sheep really is it.
Do you know what's going on with Fung?
He's out of town. I don't know. He sent me his progress report before he left, and that was as far as I know. I don't know anything more.
So we have a paper that we're submitting today.
All right.
Great.
See those.
Emay's paper. Mm-hmm.
They were the strange data, though, right?
This is normative. This is a paper on the normative.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll fill you in on some of what's going on in the clinical. And I am looking into papebral fissure size. And Kathy, you may, if you have any insights into this, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
But there seems to be, between the different norms, a lot of variability in the actual size of the papebral fissure. And it looks like the norms that people have been using were derived from data that were collected back in the 1920s on about 300 people. Then they added some data that Ken Jones had on infants. And those data, which are, I guess are published in Hall, don't agree with the Thomas Pet People Fissure charts. And so I am trying to put together an article on how all this matters. Because if you look at Susan Astley, who's always argued for the third centile, her third centile is probably over the 10th centile in the other norms. And Sterling Claren just published a paper on using photographs of a Canadian sample. And the 10th centile there comes out to about the 40th centile of Sterling's new charts. And so it seems like this is something that really needs, since papillary fissure length is critical in the diagnosis, that someone's got to figure out what's really going on here. So that's an issue that's taking place on the clinical side. Other than that, on the clinical side, things seem to be going better than they had been. People are, in fact, getting their projects done. Sarah's got a new paper coming out. I think Tatiana has another one going in. Peter Hammond is scheduled for a conference call on June 8th to discuss what he's been looking at using his algorithm, looking at the face. And so I think things are moving along and picking up, but I think this papillary fissure size has to be reconciled one way or another, because it really does matter which chart you use.
I would think that Peter would have a lot of baseline information about palpebral fissure length from all the other syndrome types of things that he's been doing and from his 3D face images.
Yeah, there's a question of whether the measurements taken from the camera are equal to what the clinicians are measuring, or whether there is a difference that's a consistent difference.
And well, that's...
popped up. I mean, it was...
Yeah, that's an important baseline question, isn't it? I mean, if we're going to have the camera data, I mean, the idea is to have that be useful. And if it's different than what's looked at in the clinic, at least you need to know by what percentage is off or on or better or worse.
Well, that's how this all really started, was Tatiana was trying to reconcile her images with the measurement, physical measurements that Ken had been taking, and where they were on the percentiles. And then we started looking at Ken's charts, and the chart that Ken has is slightly different than the Thomas chart, and we don't know why that is yet. But we're trying to figure it out, how this happened, that these two charts are slightly off. So, I mean, it's just a question, I think, that has to be answered, and it would be nice if it could be answered empirically, where absolutely went out and got measurements, you know, of papillary fissures, rather than relying on these older data, which everyone seems to have used, and yet come up with different percentiles. And they go back to the 1920s. So...
Ed, this is Charlie. I have a question. Do you have a sense, or can you get information about how much variation due to measurement variation versus biological variation you might have in both the camera and in physical measurements?
Well, we should be able to do that, because on the actual paper charts, many of these kids have been seen by two dysmorphologists. And so we should be able to get an idea of the variability in the physical measurements that different dysmorphologists have. And I think that would be, you know, an interesting question. It's not the easiest thing in the world to measure. The camera ones, the inner rate of reliability, or the measurements from two different investigators, seem to be pretty good. But just knowing where the percentiles are, I think, is really important. And then that brought up the whole issue of what's the distribution in the population of the 4 and 5 lip and philtrum. Those data are not available either. I mean, it was just kind of this Likert scale that was put out there. But we don't know what percent of the population has a 4 and 5 lip, just without any alcohol exposure. And I think these things are going to be critical as we're now down to 2 facial measurements. I think we can reconcile Susan Astley's 3rd versus our 10th percentile, given the different charts that are being used. And so I think that's a question we're going to take up on the clinical conference call. And I would like to see new charts developed and new measurements taken and start from there, just to get an idea of the norm. That, I mean, they're not based on a large number of people. I was very surprised when I went back and read the original articles on how few people really went into establishing these physical norms. And I think that's about it on the clinical front of what's going on. So, but I think after we talk to Peter, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say about all this and to see how his algorithm is going. Michael or Bill or Dale? Comments?
I have nothing new. I think we mentioned last time that we're getting some interesting data about differences in MAP kinase activity in the Harlan and Jackson mice that Kathy and Zoe have been looking at, and plan to follow up on that. But it looks to be consistent and significant. And gives us a place to go in terms of understanding it better. I think at some point it would be nice to find a cohort within the consortium to look at the pathway. We can do some pathway work in the animals, but you can almost just screen everything and figure out if there are polymorphisms that might account for susceptibility differences, and that's something that the consortium would be ideal for working out.
In line with that, there are 2 new sites that are being considered. Ken Warren, Peggy Murray, and myself went to Poland last year, and it seems that they are now getting their stuff together. There was an email over the weekend about a project they want to start, and they're funding the whole thing, but they want to use some of our methodologies. So we're looking at them as kind of a validation site, that things that we find out with our population, we could go in then and look at the Polish population and see what transfers and what doesn't.
Uh-huh.
So that may be one possibility. And the other possibility is that South Korea wants to join CFAS. And Peggy's been talking to them, and Tina and Ken may go in July. Just to see the incidents that they can find in some special orphanages there.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on.
The question is, do we have enough spit or something else from the people that we've looked at to be able to do that kind of study?
How many kids you talking? I think you're talking lots, right?
Well, yeah. You know, you
hundreds.
No, I don't think hundreds.
Yeah.
I think that what you just want to do is look for polymorphisms and have enough to be able to have a sense of whether there is a disproportionate number of polymorphisms for some of these kinases in the affected population versus a control population of exposed kids.
Well, I will bring that up on the clinical conference call, and I'll ask Tatiana how much saliva we have, spit we have.
Yeah.
Bill or Dale?
Nothing to add here. Sounds good to me.
All right. And so now you guys have to review all these progress reports and make some recommendations and things. Is that how it goes now?
That's right. And Bill, being the program officer, will formally be the one reviewing and approving, you know, the coming year's funding.
Okay.
And I have received a couple of them already.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I know we got ours in last week and stuff. All righty. Is there any other new business? All right. Well, then I look forward to seeing you all at RSA and try to keep Monday night open, all right?
Very good.
All righty.
Good.
See you then.
Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.